Hi, today is October 10th, 2021. This is Mobius Podcast 378. I'm Todd Gossward, my good friend John Westfall, and we're joined by our other good friend, Frank McPherson. Frank first appeared as a guest panelist way back in podcast number 2 in November of 2008. You know, it doesn't seem that long ago, Frank, but 13 years? Yeah.
Well, when you sent out the email a couple of weeks ago about this podcast and mentioned it's coming up on, 25 years for Windows CE? It's like, wow, and that's kind of where you and I, our friendship kind of started.
So absolutely.
That's a long time.
Absolutely. Frank, so, so as Frank mentioned, one of the things we're going to be doing over the next couple of podcasts through this calendar year is to invite a bunch of old friends who were at various points a Windows CE MVP or Windows Mobile or Windows Phone or Pocket, whatever they called it back then. It's went through a number of name changes before Microsoft finally killed it back in 2011, 2012, somewhere around then. But it's been a long time. But we'll get into that. First thing I wanted to do was talk about a couple of things that John and I have in the show notes. Should be fast. First one is John knows this. I don't know, Frank, if you've heard the podcast recently, but so about a year or so ago, I broke down and I bought an AirPods Pro, which I thought was way too expensive to buy for a long time, and I finally broke down and says, okay, I'll buy it. And they're great. They sound great. Spatial audio is awesome once John taught me how to actually listen to it correctly. And but the darn things just fall out of my ear. I just got big ear holes, as I've said. I guess. Even with the largest silicone earbud in it. So I can't go walking with them because they'll just fall out. I can sit down fine. They generally won't fall out. But walking, running, no, that ain't going to happen. So I spent a whole $48 about a week ago. And I received a no-name. I mean, literally, there's no brand name that I can figure out. A no-name $48 Bluetooth earbuds, which has two things, it turns out, that my AirPods Pro do not. And a third thing which it claims to have, which my AirPods Pro does, but it really doesn't. So for $48, I got over-the-ear hooks. So there's no wire between the two buds, and so that's great. They don't get tangled when I'm walking and I have a mask on and all that kind of stuff. And but not only do they have ear hooks, which is why I bought them, but it turns out that the charging case they come in, which kind of looks like a slightly larger version of the AirPods Pro charging case, has a digital display on the front, which shows the charge level for both earbuds, if they happen to be different, which I thought was great, because I think on the AirPods Pro, they're either yellow when they're charging and green when they're done, but this actually shows a numeric charge level. And so you know how close you are to completing the charge, and it charges pretty fast, so that was cool. The one thing it doesn't have, which is advertised on the Amazon page that I bought it from, is noise cancellation, however, and it doesn't have anything like that. Maybe they're saying, oh, you push it in the ear so it reduces noise, but that's not the same thing. That said, for $48, I'm not complaining. They're not going to solve my problem of walking when there's like traffic whizzing by or something, but that's okay, it's fine. It's a first world problem. I've been living without noise cancellation when I walk for a long time. Alrighty, now, what's this about AirPods Pro firmware update?
So there was a firmware update this week to I believe it was the AirPods 2, AirPods Pro, and AirPods Max. And of course, these firmware updates, no one ever learns about them unless you really look at your AirPods firmware that often. Apple does not really announce when they go out, and there's no way to trigger the update. So hopefully it just rolls out to you in a timely manner. But one of the interesting things that caught my eye was Conversation Boost, which is something that Apple talked about earlier this year. I can't remember if it was a WWDC or if it was it must have been WWDC, where it was just a one-off mention of, for people who have mild hearing challenges, staying more connected in conversation. The idea is that it uses the AirPods microphones to boost the volume of the person talking in front of you. And as someone who has followed kind of from a distance this whole merging of the hearing aid and tech sphere, where more and more ear headphones are being able to do a lot of the same things that hearing aids were originally designed to do, and hearing aids adding in Bluetooth capabilities now, Yet the difference in price is still quite considerable. We're talking, you know, $4,000 to $5,000 for a high-end version of the hearing aids versus $200, $300 for Bluetooth headphones. Just makes me wonder how much longer it's going to be until commercial Bluetooth headphones get people with mild hearing loss the same abilities that they would have through hearing aids.
That's pretty cool, actually. And I just checked, so the version number you need is 4A, as in alpha, 4004A400, and I checked my AirPods Pro, and that's the version I've got. I also found out my Apple Care Plus warranty expires next month, so...
good to know, I guess. And if you've never played around with the accessibility features, that's where Conversation Boost is. I'm a big fan of telling people, play around with the accessibility menu in your iPhone, because, and you know, Android has similar options, but there's so many things that we don't know about that just make your device more usable to you. You don't have to have any special impairment to use accessibility modes.
You know, this is really interesting, as, you know, people like myself who are elderly, you know, get to that point in life when our hearing will probably start to degrade. One of the things I've noticed amongst the generation that preceded me, my parents' generation, is, you know, as they need to get hearing aids, especially those who are in loud environments, or, you know, who are, have always been partially deaf because of artillery fire or something, like my dad. They always complain that, two things they complain about. One, they're uncomfortable, they being the hearing aids. And two, things are too loud once they put them in, because they've been, you know, hearing impaired for so long. Hearing the world at presumably normal volumes is really irritating to them. So it'll be interesting to see if the generation that, you know, like myself, who's older, but at least grew up, so to speak, with the AirPods and earbuds in general, will find it less vexing going forward. So I may be a candidate for this in the not too distant future. And you got something else also.
Yeah, so a couple of things. We're all getting used to iOS 15. MacRumors has a massive 50 different things that you might not know you can do on iOS 15, and so you can review the whole thing. But some of the stuff that caught my eye that I've forgotten about was that drag and drop support has been improved across the operating system. So you can now drag and drop things from places you couldn't before, including from Spotlight Search onto a home screen, which was a weird limitation in iOS 14 when we went to the app library, that you had to always drag and drop from the app library. You couldn't go from Spotlight Search, even though you're pulling up the same icons. There's now a square calendar widget that is a month view. So for those of us that recall a conversation, an infamous conversation among Windows mobile MVPs a number of years ago about who uses month view, month view is apparently popular enough to get its own widget now, which is really nice to have if you're like me and you go, well, what day is the 23rd or what day is the 14th, sort of thing. The iOS Password Manager now supports two-factor codes. So if you don't have a password manager you're using already and you've bought into Apple's ecosystem, it's good to know that you can add those in directly to the password manager. And then two other fun ones that are, you know, limited use to some people, augmented reality walking mode directions. So the picture that Apple shows is looking at a street corner and having it clearly show you that is, you know, this street or that street. Yeah, because sometimes those street signs are hard to see, even in a metropolitan area. Yeah. And when you're walking, you figure you should be able to see these things. You're not going fast, sometimes it's always been, is this the street that I'm looking for, especially if it's dark out or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And then background sounds. So if you're the kind of person that likes the, you know, ambient noise to help you concentrate, rain sounds and things like that, this is, again, buried in accessibility.
That's cool.
It's one of those things where you can turn on a variety of different sounds, pick the one you want, and either have it over audio that's already coming through, or just playing in your ear as you are walking around doing things. So that was another cool one. I'd forgotten they had even added in.
You know, I actually bought a CD set, multi-CD set, of ambient noise. You know, it had jungle sounds and rainforest sounds and all kinds of stuff, surf sounds, that I used to play in speakers in my office years ago, because I was underground, and so there was no sound at all, you know. And so you know, I put that on to just kind of have a feeling of not being not being trapped underground.
I've always had an evil genius idea that I've never done, but the idea would be to combine those sounds together to tell a story and not tell someone that that's what's happening. So, you know, it starts off with the jungle sounds,
yeah.
And then the rain comes in, and then, you know, the animals get more aggressive, and then you hear this, like, fast running through the jungle, and then, like, a fire crackling, and just, you know, the story that by the end of it, you're thinking something really happened there.
And maybe a random scream near the end.
Yeah, a random scream at the end, and a helicopter coming down, and just really, and then the hustle and bustle of Times Square. Something just really strange to make you wonder what happened to you.
That is a great idea, and I would listen to it. I would definitely listen to it if you ever do
it. If I ever put it together, Todd, I will send you a copy first.
All right. Now on to the main thing. So as Frank mentioned earlier, we're getting together because, you know, Windows CE turns 25 years old next year. And Windows CE doesn't exist anymore, you know. At least I don't think it does. You know, it might be hidden in some device somewhere, some IoT-like device somewhere. It used to be an audio CarPlay and all kinds of stuff like that. Or it wasn't CarPlay, whatever it's called. Microsoft Auto, I think.
The relating technology to Windows CE that I am reasonably certain is still active.
Uh-huh.
Is ActiveSync, because it is still the protocol used by systems like, well, AirWatch,
yeah.
That interact with Exchange servers. And I just so happened, the reason why it comes to mind is just in my work life, I've come across that topic recently, and it was a bit of a deja vu, because that is, a genesis back to the topic at hand, the Windows CE and handheld PC days.
Yeah, and for folks, or our friends at least, who I hope are listening to at least this podcast, some of us used to refer to ActiveSync as Active Stink, because...
Oh, ActiveSync it gets me PTSD. You know, I literally have these moments where I'm going, why? As someone who ran an Exchange server back during the Windows Pocket PC era, and especially when we were first getting push email... through that, and going, why is ActiveSync doing this? And I used to have 100 conflicted copies of ActiveSync, directories on my computer and all those things.
Yeah, ActiveSync, oh gosh, yeah, that does bring back mostly very bad memories. But anyway, as I said, you know, so Frank and I met in 96, somewhere around then.
Yeah.
So pretty close. Well, no, it couldn't have been 96 because Windows CE came in 96.
Probably
so
more like 97 or 98.
97, yeah. After Windows CE had been around for maybe a year or so. And so we've known each other for almost a quarter of a century, and we would not have known each other were it not for Windows CE. I mean, I think the odds are like probably zero. And we were both MVPs, like John, in various times. I think Frank, you and I, and Jason Dunn, and Christy Herrera, and Craig Peacock were the first five Windows CE MVPs that I recall. Was there some? I might be somebody I'm missing, but I don't think so.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was all when we could all fit in one car when we went to places together, or one SUV at least. Mm-hmm. Later on, as John will remember, when the group got quite larger, we needed a bus to get us around Redmond and Seattle and Bellevue and other places we visited together for conferences and so forth. But so what was your... So my very first Windows CE device was the HP 320LX. I skipped the 300 because the 320LX has some feature that I can't remember what it was that really made it worth waiting for. Did I remember? I just don't remember what it was offhand. It had a stylus, and it had, grayscale screen, no color yet. It had a little version, a mini version of Word and Excel, and a couple other things. And it was great. You know, it was like it was a little tiny PC. In fact, I think they referred to it as a PC Companion. What was your first one, Frank? Because you were back in that era.
I think actually it's the same model. I know it was the Hewlett-Packard, and I can't remember if it was the 300 or 320, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But I was looking back again in preparation for this. I had to dig up the definitive book on the topic, which is ours. that from back then in 2000, and I looked at the specs. You know, it's interesting to look back at this in terms of some of the specs for the handheld PCs. I bulleted them out. Obviously, you mentioned your clamshell device is about 7 inches long.
Yeah,
powered by alkaline batteries.
That's right. I forgot.
There, you know, not many people, you know, think of any mobile device today of any seriousness, right? That had alkaline batteries. Obviously, the gist of replaceable batteries carried on, and ironically, today just about no device that you buy has a replaceable battery.
That's right.
You mentioned the keyboard input and everything else. The other interesting thing is the processors in these devices were all variations of RISC processors.
Hmm.
And for those of us that are in the IT as part of our career, right, RISC goes back to some much larger computing devices.
Yeah.
They're kind of the next generation processing architecture from the PCs that were targeted towards servers. And apparently there was a line of RISC processors that were used for mobile that was pretty much the dominant processor used by these devices at the time. The other big feature that was actually important to me, if you think back at that time, right, it was a transition for me, it was a transition from the Newton message pad to what was next. To mention from an anniversary perspective, right, Tuesday was the 10th anniversary of the passing of Steve Jobs.
Mm.
And the interesting thing is that Steve is a big reason why I ended up using Windows CE. Why? Because when he returned back to Apple, Newton was one of the things that he killed. It was a product of John Sculley's. He didn't like it. He killed it. And those of us who saw the writing on the wall, because it didn't literally happen in 96, knew it was going to happen. And so I was looking for another device. And the key feature on the handheld PC that because the options then were between the Palm Pilots or the Windows CE devices. And I picked the handheld PC because it had a PC card slot, or what
That's
was
right.
known as PCM CIA slots.
Right. Big,
for
huge
expandability.
Thing. Yeah.
Yeah. But that was the standard, right, for expansion in laptop computers at the time, and they carried that over to these devices. But the point being that it was expandable as opposed to some of the original Palms that weren't as openly expandable. And then one other key feature to these devices at that time was the wireless communications, which was infrared. Or an IRDA compliant infrared port, right? So you could do a wireless communications to something. But I think even back then you could get apps that like controlled TVs, right? But
right, you're right.
The idea back to the mention about ActiveSync, right, was the connection back to the PCs, and that was another big thing for me. I had Newton, and one of the frustrating things is that they made that as a standalone device. It didn't have a very good integration with desktop computers or any type of sharing of data in any easy way. And one of the things that Microsoft did when they brought this out, again, you mentioned they treated these as PC companions, to have that truly be the case, there needed to be the way for the two to communicate with each other. And they originally came out with the handheld PC Explorer that did the browsing and the communications and the synchronization with everything. Sync was part of the product from the beginning, and then that eventually became ActiveSync. But that, you know, out of the box was another important feature to me. So that's a bit of why I went and ended up with Windows CE at all from the Newton message pads that were the kind of the very first devices in these categories. And Pilot was obviously an alternative to the handheld PCs at the time, and were fairly competitive. Well, probably Palm Pilots were really more dominant in truthfulness, but they were an entirely different approach to things.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, prior to the Newton, I might still have somewhere an HP 95LX. And it was not a handheld PC. HP 95LX, I don't know what they called it. you know, mobile computer or something. But it was running on MS-DOS. It wasn't CE. And it was a great little device, too. It was much less functional than, you know, the CE devices, of course. But it really got me, I think it really got me started. Like you, I had a Newton. And, you know, it's funny. I think I had to write some assembler code on a PC to somehow talk to the Newton to get my data off of it. I remember it was really convoluted when I wanted to get my data off of that thing. And, oh my gosh, I forgot about the alkaline batteries. I used to carry spare AAA or AA batteries? I can't remember now. Spare AA batteries. AAA? I used to carry spare batteries in a little Ziploc bag whenever I traveled. And I used to travel every month back then. And so I'd carry these little, you know, little batteries in a Ziploc bag, and they'd probably be confiscated today. I don't know. But, but yeah. Wow, I'd forgotten all that stuff. That's pretty fun stuff. And so, John, what was you came a little bit into the game a little bit later, as I recall. I remember you were telling us last week that you saw some stuff at a friend's house, but
I did see some CE devices. My first CE device was by then a Pocket PC. It was the Pocket PC Phone Edition, the original XDA Wallaby from HTC, or the HTC Wallaby. Yeah. So I didn't really get to play with CE other than seeing other people having it. At the time, I was using a Palm M500, and then I upgraded to an M505. And I could do, was just mentioned, Frank said, you know, consumer IR. I remember using it as a remote control, and you could literally draw out the buttons, and it was probably the best universal remote I ever had, to the point that I've almost thought about picking one up again. just to have it do that, because it's a pretty cool thing that we don't have anymore. But yeah, I was late to the party. I definitely went the Palm route versus the Windows CE route for at least the first few years there.
I have a funny story about how I got my first phone, you know, CE phone. And Frank might remember this because we were around together and we were in fact involved in this process. So Frank and I and some of the friends I mentioned earlier, Jason and so forth, we're involved in a early beta of Windows CE, I forget what the version was called, but what we had to do, because you couldn't flash it yourself, is you had to mail your Pocket PC, I guess that's what we called it. Did we call it Pocket PC already? I forget. We had to mail
Pocket PC Phone Edition.
Yeah, no, well, this is before that. I had to mail in my my iPac. And so I mailed in my iPac. I didn't have a Phone Edition yet, although it had just come out. I mailed my Compaq iPac to Microsoft, to Redmond, and as Frank did, I'm sure, and other people did, to get it flashed to a beta release so we could test it. And I got a phone call shortly after they received it. It said, is this Todd? Yeah, and this is, you know, whoever it was. You know, when we flashed your phone, we kind of fried it. I mean, not your phone. When we flashed your iPac, we fried it. And, you know, that was like $1,000, $800, whatever it was. It was really pricey back then. It was $800. And they said, would it be okay with you if we just sent you a Pocket PC Phone Edition to replace it? And I didn't have one, you know, and it was kind of expensive, too. So I said, yeah. Go ahead. That'll be fine. You know, it's really sad, but yeah, let's do that. And that's how I got my first Pocket PC Phone Edition. It was quite by accident. I'm not sure I would have bought one because, like I said, it was really expensive, and I had already paid for that iPac. That was quite a bit of money.
That was probably an HTC device.
Yeah.
I mean, Microsoft and HTC had the relationship. I think they were doing a lot of the development together on those devices, and so it was probably one of those, one of their original early devices. It was probably on T-Mobile.
Yes. And, in fact, T-Mobile was the only carrier that had it.
HTC. Yeah, it was the HTC Wallaby. That was the one that I had, the initial Pocket PC Phone Edition.
Yeah.
Which was just called in the U.S. the T-Mobile Pocket PC Phone Edition.
That's right. And as I think Frank will remember, too, when we first saw it before any of us had it, because I think it was still a prototype mode, Microsoft actually had captive cell towers just for testing their Pocket PC Phone Edition on campus. And I remember we were on a little shuttle or something. And our host at the time, Derek Brown, who was director of marketing for Windows CE, pulled this Pocket PC, which none of us had seen yet, I think it was a prototype or a pre-release at least, pulled a Pocket PC Phone Edition out of his pocket and said, let's see where we are. And, you know, grabbed a map and, you know, I think he had a GPS, PCMCIA card or something, and made a phone call to us, you know, on our regular junky non-smartphones. And we were just amazed. Oh, and I think he brought up Internet Explorer too. So it was really, really a revolutionary for us, at least for me, device, and it changed the way I thought about mobile devices. You know, this is back in 2001. In fact, it must have been just before 9/11. It was probably a Mobius conference we were at that ended on September 9th, 2001, as I recall correctly. At least that's when I flew back. It's kind of one of those dates, you know, burned in memory. But yeah, that was pretty darn amazing. So what's your all-time favorite device, Frank, for any of them?
Well, in you know, I mean, actually, interesting. You used the word Windows CE, yeah, which is actually pretty much tied to the handheld PCs, right? The
well, it was used PCs, in all, but
they called it Pocket PC, yeah, because you know, I mean, it'd be hard to not say that the best of all those devices, because it is the one that really made, you know, what success there was on this product for Microsoft, yeah, came because of the compact iPack.
Yes.
And, you know, it was very different than everybody else's, because it was a completely enclosed device.
Yep.
So it was more like than the Palms, but actually very much a predecessor to what we now see in the devices today, in the iPhones and the Android devices. But they recognized the value of expansion, and so they had a port at the bottom of them that I don't know. I'm sure it was actually some version of a standard expansion bus. But basically, the whole idea is you would slide the device into a sleeve,
mm-hmm,
into these expansion sleeves, and you could, it was everything from adding a compact flash card slot to a full PC card slot, yeah, to a battery pack extensions to just a case, like a leather case. It looked different. It had a lot of utility and flexibility. It was the device that probably sold the most, so it's hard. And it was really the first device that was, I think, launched with Pocket PC, which was new. If you remember, yep, Todd, that fateful day when we were on the campus of Microsoft and saw it for the first time. And I think it was a day later that was the press conference for it that we were at to allegedly, I think, handhold press people in their review of the devices or something. But when I go back and look at some of the handheld PCs, the HP really made a lot of good devices. And they had... you know, there was a category of handhelds after the ones we talked about called the handheld pros.
Yeah.
And they had one, I know you're going to mention the 720, which was mm-hmm, kind of the next gen of your first device, which was very good. But the other device that came out around that time was the 820.
Yes, that was excellent. Which was
a little bit larger, and it had a better typing, a larger keyboard, so you could actually type on it. I really enjoyed that. It was for a handheld PC. I mean, it really wasn't handheld,
right?
It was more laptop-ish,
right?
But it was smaller and portable and light. It served a lot. It was very useful for me at that time, just typing, taking notes, and things of that nature.
Yeah. So it was an instant on notebook. That was a wonderful thing about Windows CE handhelds and handheld PC Pros and handheld PC 2000 models, is they were truly instant on, and we would not see that for many, many, many years in other devices running, you know, regular Windows or even Mac OS, really, where we would see an instant on. I think we would probably have to wait for the iPad in 2010 to just go, oh, that's exactly what I need. On, off, on, off, on, off, you know. The distinction is a touch. But yeah, that's a good. I still have my E20, as a matter of fact. Yep, and there are a bunch of good ones. There are really a bunch of good ones, and it really changed the way we were. At least you and I. I mean, it was never became popular. I do want to say something. You know, since you mentioned the 10th anniversary of Steve Jobs passing, a couple of years ago, I interviewed Frank Amont, who was the handheld PC 2000 product manager. Well, around that era, one of his claim to fame, and another great device was the Clio, if you remember that one. I remember buying one of those too. And Frank told me, you know, because since I guess all the NDAs had been lifted at this point, and decades later, two decades later probably, that Microsoft actually had a secret meeting with Apple to try to get Apple to develop a mobile device. And this is post-Newton. You know, Steve Jobs is back. To get Apple to develop a mobile device running Windows CE. Now, obviously, this fell apart. Didn't we? You know, we never saw such a thing. But the meeting did take place. And it's kind of interesting to wonder what Apple would have done. And if you think, well, Apple would never do that. I remind you of, not you personally, Frank, but I remind you know our fives of listeners that Apple did team with Motorola pre-iPhone to develop I can't remember what they called it, but it was basically a Motorola cell phone that you know could synchronize with iTunes and things like that.
Well, and they had a keyboard based version of the Newton message pad.
That's right.
It was targeted at education markets.
That's right.
The other interesting thing at the time, and it gives probably another reason why Steve killed it, the Newton software, the Newton OS, is darn near the only product that Apple licensed for other manufacturers. The message pad was not the only Newton device that was sold on launch day. That Sharp and I think Casio both sold, or maybe it was just Sharp that sold a alternative product, maybe a little lower in price, but it ran the same software. And so that was the one time that Apple experimented with this idea of licensing to OEMs. And doing that model that Microsoft did with all these devices we're talking about today, right? The handhelds and all that. None of these are Microsoft manufactured devices. They continued the model that they had previously established with DOS and with Windows and so forth and carried that forward. Of course, ironically, now today, things are completely upside down from where they were back 25 years ago in what we're talking about. But, you know, when Steve came back, that whole concept was up, except for the interlude with the iPod. There was one iPod that Hewlett Packard.
That's right.
Sold,
I remember that.
And that's it. And I, you know, that was probably in the same conversation. I don't know what was influenced when they talked Steve into allowing them to create a version of iTunes for the Windows. That made iPod successful, but it was probably in that time frame that HP got the opportunity to actually sell their own iPods.
Yeah, and as you mentioned earlier, my favorite Windows CE device, and I count anything that ran Windows CE, which is basically everything up until just before the Windows Phone, which was, you know, a whole different animal. So anything up until then, I consider Windows CE. But my favorite was the HP Giornata 720, as you mentioned earlier, because it was... It was tiny. It was into that 7-inch, you know, long framework. But the keyboard was just amazing for this tiny little chiclet-sized keypad. And I think I mentioned to John last week, I actually typed out a book chapter or something on it when I was doing some work back then. And it was, you know, sitting in a car waiting for my daughter or something. But in any case, John, what was your favorite Windows CE device? Anything up until Windows Phone, which is... You know, a different animal, in my opinion.
So anything up until Windows Phone, it's a hard choice between what was the coolest and what was the most usable. The coolest, I think, was the HTC Universal or the IMA Jazz Jar, the clamshell with the flippable screen and probably the best keyboard. But it was a little bit too big in terms of pocketable and all that. So the one I'm actually going to go with was the Titan 2. Let me find what the code name was for that, because the Titan 2 was, I think, how AT&T branded it in
I have to go look
the
it
United
up
States.
What's that?
But it was very similar to the, it was the second generation of kind of this small form. Yeah, it was just the HTC Titan 2, or the HTC Kaiser was the code name. Came out in 2007. And I would argue, if you were thinking about what was the quintessential peak of Windows Mobile before Windows Phone, in terms of a device where you had a small enough form factor to be pocketable, you had a keyboard that was usable, you had a unique ability to slide and then pivot the screen up. I was a big fan of the Titan 2.
I'm looking at a picture now. It's
Is that the predecessor to like the original Android phone, the G phone? Is this the one that slid up? Screen slid up?
Yeah, it had a similar sliding mechanism. Not exactly the same slider, but a similar.
Conceptually. Yeah. Beginning.
Yeah, I just put a link in our Teams chat area.
Yeah, it was a very capable little device, what I consider kind of the peak version of pre-Windows Phone. The best evolution of everything that was different than what we would get with iPhone and Slate, style phones, and everything that Microsoft could have had moving forward, and then they didn't.
Yeah, and there were so many really good, interesting designs coming out of, the various hardware manufacturers that were building around Windows CE. And although people may forget this, at one point, I can't remember if it was the Pocket PC itself or the Pocket PC, with phone, but it was number two in the market, just behind Palm. And by number two, it wasn't a distant two, it was pretty darn close. It may have been even number one at one point, with, maybe 25, 30% of the market. And to give some context, I think the iPhone today only has about 17% in the market. So, iPhone is considered wildly successful and popular. But it only has 17% of the overall smartphone market, with, the rest of it being mostly Android. So it had a good chunk of the market and had quite a bit of success until they messed it up with the Windows Phone.
Well, part of that was due to the fact that Palm got acquired through 3Com, and they started a slow descent because they kind of stuck to a design that became very old. And Microsoft and their OEMs tried to keep iterating. So in that, in the 2004, 2003, 2004, 2005 were probably the golden ages of Pocket PC and Microsoft's success in this area. And of course, we all got knocked off the pedestal, if you will, when iPhone got launched. That was a jolt in 2007, and shortly thereafter, as iPhone kind of ascended, everything else kind of fell to the side, and Microsoft continued at that point vainly to try to stay in shape when they finally started dramatically changing the UIs. Interestingly enough, if you talk about technology that lingers around today, the tile-based menu that was part of the start menu in Windows 10, maybe hanging on in widgets in Windows 11 today, that comes from Zune, that was part of the last vestiges of Pocket PC that we saw. So that's the end of the legacy, if you will, because Zune was that thing. Again, if you remember, Todd, when we first saw Pocket PC, there was a big debate. The big issue at the time was in the critics on Microsoft, is Microsoft just took a Windows UI and tried to scale it down and think that was going to work. And whereas Palm was an entirely different UI, it was optimized for a small screen portrait device. And it wasn't until Zune that they are willing to actually experiment with an entirely different UI for a mobile device. And lo and behold, it actually was successful to them. It's not like Zune, it was late again in trying to compete with an iPod, but lots of people found that UI to be useful and very nice. And then they tried to apply it at that Pocket PC, but at that point, it was a little too late for them in terms of ever recapturing the market, any type of market share that would make it worthwhile for them to stay in.
Yeah, and I can't I want to take credit for something, but it's probably credit not really due to a bunch of people. But in 05, 06, when we were at a MVP summit or you know, one of those kind of things up there, a whole bunch of us were carrying iPods already. I mean, not already. This is, you know, a couple of years. iPods came out in 01. This was 05, 06. And we were all really, really thrilled with our iPods. I mean, that's, you know, because it had enough storage and the UI was great. And I remember, I want to take credit, but this might be credit not really deserving to me. Probably a couple of us said something like it. We were at a panel session, and a bunch of us held up our iPads and said, you know, this thing is awesome. You know, look at this. Look at the UI. And this is post wheel. So this was like the Nanos, you know. It was already not a mechanical wheel anymore. And we said, you know, if Apple ever makes a phone, you guys are doomed. And they kind of said, oh, Apple, they don't know anything about making a phone. They can't make a phone. Don't worry about it. And of course, you know, a year or two later in 07 says, hey, looky over here.
And he mentioned the connection there, right? Because the big thing for iPhone when it was launched, the big debate is that, you know, iPhone was all touch interface, right? Before that, every device had a stylus.
Yes.
Right? And Steve famously basically said, if you have to use a stylus, you know, that's the surest sign of a piece of junk. I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically what he was saying. But the big debate was the on-screen keyboard. Right. Because up to that point, and we mentioned the handheld PCs, right, there was and the Blackberries were the epitome of this. The idea is that if you wanted to do any serious amount of data input, you needed a physical keyboard. People wanted buttons.
Yep.
And Apple was saying, trust us, on-screen keyboard. And of course, you know, as persistence and improvement on the software came about, Steve was, you know, and Apple was proven right. We all use on-screen keyboards today with our phones. Though, you know, anybody that's a serious amount of data entry and like on an iPad is probably going to add a magic keyboard or some type of external keyboard to it, which was, you know, part of the scene all back those 25 years ago when it really comes down to it.
And, you know, the funny thing is, I remember I was at a conference, not a Microsoft conference. I was just at like a conference on Maui. I can't remember what it was like some visitors thing, and I was asked to speak on mobile technology there. And I remember, you know, I had an iPad or something like it, and I, you know, somebody said, hey, may I see it? And I said, sure. And, you know, I handed it over to him, and he touched my screen with his grubby finger, which is a no-no, right, back then, because we didn't have what's called oleophobic screens or whatever that rejects. And so, you know, if you touch a screen, it gets really fingerprinty and oily and filthy. And says, no, you got to use a stylus. And the guy looks at me and goes, stylus? You know, it would be much easier to touch the finger, you know, which, you know, looking back on it, that guy was totally correct, although he did, you know, really make my screen look messy. But that's...
Well, one thing we have to remember, I think, was that when Windows CE and Pocket PC and all that came out, the touchscreen format that we all had was a resistive touchscreen, which was not very responsive to fingers and not very responsive to anything other than a stylus. And so when Apple was saying, no, we're going to do everything with an on-screen keyboard, I think all of us defaulted to remembering how horrible that was under a resistive screen. And that was when capacitive screens first starting to become the more common format. So, you know, Apple knew that if you had never used a resistive screen, you would have no problem thinking about using your fingers directly on the screen, especially I'm sure they knew oleophobic screens were possible and were in early development at that time. So I think that was one of the things that hampered us in thinking about the success of the iPhone, probably hampered Microsoft as well, because we were thinking, oh, we tried that 10 years ago and it was horrible. And, well, yeah, because the technology 10 years ago was horrible for it. The technology in 2007 was not.
Yeah, although there was a company, I think it was called SPH. Does that ring a bell? I think there was a company called SPH who had a, you know, they're a third party. They had an add-on app for the Pocket PC that put a usable touchscreen keyboard on the screen. And I remember it was pretty good. You know, you could use it with a stylus, you could use it with a finger, and even with the finger, wasn't too bad. So, you know, people were thinking about it way back then. SPB, thank you. SPB. Yeah, I forgot. I wonder if they're still around. But they actually had a whole bunch of really interesting, you know, third party applications. I'm just checking to see if they're still around. I don't see them anywhere. But it was a, you know, sign of things. And it's funny you mention that, because I remember, you all probably remember that the first tablet PC came out in 2000 or 2001 also, the Microsoft tablet PC running Windows XP or whatever it was back then. And although it was fascinating, I remember seeing some folks in the airplane with them, but they all were using a keyboard. None of them used a touchscreen or as a tablet. It too had a terrible experience. Well, first of all, it ran about 4,000 degrees, so you'd burn your hands if you used it for any amount of time. And we'd have to wait 10 years for, you know, for an iPad to get it right, and, you know, not to burn your hands while you're using it. So, you know, again, Apple took its time. I mean, it waited years and years and years until it released something. But then it was like, oh, yeah, that's how it's supposed to work. Now it makes sense. Yeah, good times. Good times indeed.
Yeah, I think there's been, I mean, to John's point, I think that when you're within the time, you don't see the constraints very clearly that you're working under. And I think in a lot of these technologies that we're talking about, you were bound by the constraints of what was available. The screen technology then, the batteries, the processors, none of that stuff was, capable of doing the types of things that we now take for granted in our iPhones, iPads, Android, or any of that type of stuff today. The processing, you might have been able to get processors that were as powerful as what we have today, and would have a battery life that lasts 10 minutes or something. So,
yeah.
You know, getting something that was usable and it wasn't ungodly expensive was a challenge. And so, you know, we ended up with, you know, devices that were fairly mediocre, and it was just really enthusiasts like you and I were, Todd, that saw what it might be and committed ourselves to kind of using it and sticking with it in hopes that someday it would achieve the vision that we all, you know, really wanted it to be.
Yeah, where we are today, pretty much.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because I remember in one of the very early podcasts, you know, probably like podcast two, I brought you on because aside from the fact we were friends even back then, but I brought you on because you had just gotten the T-Mobile G1, the first Android phone, and you had bought a giant add-on third-party battery pack for that thing, because I think your battery didn't last through lunch or something like that.
You're never going to let that go, are you?
No, and I say that because I bought a G1 too. But I returned it within the 14-day, you know, return policy, because it just, mine didn't survive through lunch either. It would just, you know, it'd be dead, and I'd have to go, you know, plug it in somewhere or whatever. And so I returned it within the 14-day return policy, and, you know, I paid like a $10 stocking fee or something. And I always said, okay, that's it. I'm going to go buy an iPhone. And so I think I bought the iPhone 3G. So I was not an early adopter for the iPhone, but, you know, the G1 convinced me I needed something with better battery. Even though I thought the G1 had more promise. It had a physical keyboard. It had a little trackball on it, as I recall. It was a pretty wonderful little device, except that, you know, it would die by lunchtime, except for that part. Speaking of other devices, I don't know if you guys remember, but there were some non-mobile CE devices. I was going to say my favorite, but they're both great. One was fairly well known. That's a Sega Dreamcast, which was Sega game console running Windows CE, talking about, you know, other devices running Windows CE. And it had some really great games on it. A lot of the Sega characters and stuff. So it was a lot of fun. Sonic the Hedgehog, you know, those kind of games, a lot of good racing games. But the other, which really never took off, but it had such promise, was the MSN Companion, which was a all-in-one device. It looked like a tiny little 1996 iMac, you know, with a screen and computer and a separate keyboard. But it ran Windows CE. It had Internet Explorer 4 or something in it, or 6, maybe not even 6. And it just sort of sat on your kitchen table. It was always on, or, you know, wherever you put it. It was always on. You could surf the web. You could It had some utilities to do other things for news, separate from the web. It was a great idea that, you know, today lives on in things like this, like a Google Smart Assistant, devices from a variety of places, or from the Amazon Echo, for example, Echo Show type devices. So those two, the Amazon Companion and the Sega Dreamcast, were just a lot of fun and way ahead of their time, I think. I really miss those devices. Although, like I said, today we have their successors, maybe not digital genetic successors, it's not Windows devices, but, you know, running from Google and other Apple and other companies and Amazon, surprisingly enough. All righty. That's about all I have in terms of questions and comments. I don't know if you guys want to go anywhere with this, but boy, it was an interesting ride. You know, it didn't last 25 years. You know, it died 1996, birth. When was the last Windows phone? 2012? I can't remember. Somewhere around then. I'm sorry, Frank, you were going to say something?
Well, I was to say, I mean, and the handhelds were pretty much done well before that, right? So,
yeah,
you know, like I said, when iPhone launched in 2007, that marked a milestone in terms of the Microsoft products and kind of the decline.
Yeah.
You know, whether there were last gasp, you know, everything from the redo of the UI to the purchase of Nokia, the Lumias,
yeah,
you know, all those devices that they try to hang on to. You know, you're right. It probably 2012, 2013 would be kind of the end. Of course, now they're making a comeback with a different operating system, but just with hardware with the Duo 2,
yeah,
which is, you know, an interesting concept. And you know, like I said, the how things go full circle. You know, back, you know, you and I, Todd, like you mentioned, we were part of product reviews and early discussions with Microsoft on the releases of their software. And back then there was serious debate, or, you know, people like us saying, you know, really, Microsoft, if you want to be serious in mobile, you got to consider your own hardware.
Yeah.
Or at least partner with one company.
Yeah.
Right? And optimized. And, you know, they were adamant that that was not them. That was not their model.
Right.
They did probably partner with HTC as, yeah, the closest. Ultimately, they bought Nokia. But now Microsoft is very much a hardware manufacturing company. You know, they have their own products, which they would not have all considered at the time. Now, you can,
true,
debate, you know, success of that and why they're even doing it. But, you know, it would have been interesting if had Microsoft at all considered doing something like that, whether they would have had at all better success. And, of course, they were also constrained by viewing, you know, really strongly believing that everything had to look like Windows, that they were a Windows company, and they didn't allow themselves to deviate or even consider deviation from that until it was much too late.
Yeah. The other problem they had is they refused to cannibalize their own products. So, you know, Apple famously, like when they released, when they went from the iPod, the original iPod, to I think the Nano or something like it, they said, okay, no more hard drives. We're done. You know, everything's going to be solid state and it's going to be smaller, but too bad. You know, get used to it. And everybody said, okay. And, you know, they made the switch. Whereas Microsoft, you know, they hobbled themselves with these little kind of toy versions of Word and Access. I remember when you were writing your Pocket PC or Windows CE or Pocket PC book, you really struggled with trying to find a useful example of using Microsoft Access for Windows CE. And we talked about it for a while. But I, you know, it was so weak. It was like, gee, Frank, how are you going to pull this one out of your hat?
Yeah, it was a stretch. You know, it's interesting, back to the, you know, the mention that John mentioned about the him, or you did, Todd, about that HP 95LX, the MS-DOS machine.
Yeah.
Really, I think the reason why HP made that is because of Lotus 1-2-3. That was, you know, back then,
point.
Lotus was, you know, the app, right? The killer app for personal computers. And they had a version of that for that little handheld device. Their thinking was it would be a portable spreadsheet device.
Right.
And software. And so, you know, I think that, again, that was part of that template or thinking somewhat carried over to the way Microsoft viewed these handheld devices, that, okay, people are going to want these really portable versions, these small versions of these full-blown desktop PC apps, whether it be Excel or Access or whatever. And, you know, they're going to really want that. And maybe they did, but the ability to make it really functional on such a small device was a hard challenge to overcome. And again, they just wouldn't think outside the box of what they were trying to do.
Yeah. And they wouldn't do things like, if you remember, they wouldn't do full round tripping for documents going from the mobile device back to the desktop. So you would actually lose, formatting. So if you took something with, say, tables or something fancy in your Word document desktop and somehow got it to your mobile device and edited it and you sent it back, it says, hey, where'd my table go? You know, and so round tripping was a huge debate we had with Microsoft. Like, you got to support round tripping. You got to preserve everything, even if you can't actually use it on a mobile device. And they, for years, they refused to do it. Another thing that I remember they refused to do that drove me nuts was over-the-air synchronization. Once the Pocket PC Phone Edition came out, I remember asking them soon after, is why do we have to use a tethered active sync or IR active sync at our desktop to synchronize calendars and contacts? Why can't we just synchronize with Hotmail? Just put a calendar and contacts in Hotmail and let us synchronize with Hotmail. And they go, oh, no, nobody wants to do that. I says, well, I want to do it. And he says, well, you guys are, you know, you're extreme people. You know, you don't represent the general consumer public. And we go, oh, whatever. But, hey, we were right.
Yes, the consumer public wants things to be harder. You're absolutely right, Microsoft. They would like it to be more difficult. It gives people a sense of satisfaction to break out the cables and set everything up. And it's sort of like heroin users saying that, you know, all the preparations to using the drug makes it more enjoyable. It's exactly like that, Microsoft. You should not make it any easier for them.
And I should note, as you know, the good Dr. Westfall is a professional cognitive psychologist, so he knows what of he speaks.
Yes.
But it was we had a lot of interesting discussions with Microsoft in Redmond, person to person, face to face before it was a super spreader event. It was very interesting times. I'm glad we went through it. I'm glad I got to know folks like you. Frank, you know, we've known each other nearly a quarter century now. Yep, pretty close to a quarter century, if not actually. And it's been a remarkable journey, I think, for all of us to see what's going on. It's by the way, Frank, I know you're an Android user these days. I think. Are you looking at the Pixel 6 or whatever?
No. I have a Pixel 4a. It's got Android 12 on it. I will stick with that until they stop doing Android updates, and then I'll look to the next model. I just can't get myself to spend $1,000 for a smartphone. I go, supposedly the Pixel 6 is going to be a little more reasonably priced, like 708-ish, which is a little better. But I am probably more of an A series, you know, 500 or lower would be what I would want to spend on a phone. And I am happy that Google, at least for now, appears to be willing to have that mid-tier and a high-end. And, you know, God bless them. If you have success with the high-end, go for it.
I also have a 4A, but I have a different reason for sticking with it. And that is because when I looked at the specs for the current revs, I don't know, I think it was a 5A or whatever, it no longer provides you with unlimited uploads to Google Photos, whereas the 4A still lets me have unlimited photo uploads, using compressed storage, but those photos are good enough for me. I'm happy with that level of compression, so I'm going to keep using this because it's the only way I can continue shooting, you know, lots and lots and lots of photos and not having to pay extra for the storage. I still have about 100 gigabytes free in my paid. I do have a Google One subscription, so I do have a lot of space, but hey, you know what? Unlimited is still better. So I'm going to, like you, I'm going to stick with my 4A, but for maybe a little bit different reason. John, did you decide whether or not to go to 13? I am not. I just, no.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm not going with the 13 or the Apple Watch Series 7. I'm just holding off this year.
Same. We both did, however, get the Mini 5. I'm sorry, Mini 6, which is, and I got to tell you, Frank, I don't know if you heard the previous podcast where John and I were talking about receiving our Mini 6. So, you know, I have a Mini 5. I gave it to my wife, but, you know, I had a Mini 5. And it's a perfectly good device, except I wanted to have an Apple II, Pencil 2 and some other things on it. And I thought, well, this would be kind of an evolutionary upgrade, right? You know, a couple of good things, and, you know, it's newer and blah, 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 and that's that. The Apple Mini 6 has been a revolutionary device for me in some ways. It's a lot of little things that make a difference, like supporting spatial audio, which the Mini 5 doesn't. Neither does the iPad Pro 2018. I think you need a 2020 or later to support it. And so little things like that, Apple Pencil 2 support, iPad spatial audio support. I'm now almost using it exclusively. I have to pull out my 2020 iPad Pro once a week just to make sure what the battery charge level is like and charge it up. But I haven't been using it since I got the Mini 6. And I saw you just held up something. Frank, was that a Mini 6
well,
also?
I have the 5.
Okay.
No, I bought the 5. I had a 4 before this.
Yep.
And you know, that was the only Mini for a very long time.
Yes. So
by the time the 5 came out, the 4 was very long in the tooth.
Yeah.
And you know, just even things like the Kindle app, which is frankly the main thing I use this for, reading ebooks. So I, as soon as the Mini 5 was released, I got one.
Yeah.
And so but that was what, a year ago? A little over a year ago? Not that long ago. And so a little hard in my mind to run out right now, especially considering I bought an iPad Air last year. If I had not got the Air, probably I would already have the Mini 6 in hand. Okay. But that's kind of where the log. I will probably get a Mini 6, whether it's Christmas time or the beginning of next year. But right now, for the moment, I'm holding off.
FYI, I just checked. So the Mini 5 came out in March 18, 2019. So it's been it was 2.5 years between the 5 and the 6. And I think it was 3 or 4 years between the 4 and the 5. So, you know, Apple does not do annual releases. This is kind of, you know, John and I constantly worry that they're going to discontinue it.
Yeah, we were pretty convinced that after the 4, they were just going to discontinue it.
Yeah. Yeah, we had several sad discussions about that. So I hope that, you know, enough fans keep it alive, because, wow, I am just really, really enjoying the Mini 6. It is significantly different from the 5, and the battery life is pretty darn good, and I'm not really seeing the jelly roll problem that other people are complaining about. But it might be because I'm old and I just scroll slower than young people. I'm not sure. You know? But really, really impressive. I keep saying, if I have some time, you know, spend an hour to sit down and write a little personal blog item about the Mini 6, because I'm just so darn impressed with it. Although it does have some quirks, like some of my favorite software does not run correctly on it. Procreate and ArtSet 4 being the ones that come to mind. But, you know, one of the interesting things, before we go, I don't know if you've ever run into this, but when your favorite thing, or usually application, just sort of acts quirky, sometimes it's interesting to go to an alternative and go, hey, you know, this alternative is not too bad. And so I've been using Infinite Painter, which has the advantage of not only running on an iOS device, it also runs on Android and Chrome. Or at least Chrome and an Android emulator on. And so I can literally use it anywhere. And it's been a lot of fun for my little doodle a day project. So really enjoying using Infinite Painter on an iPad Mini 6, since Procreate and ArtSet 4 are just being quirky on it. Anyway, I want to thank Frank McPherson for joining John and me for today's podcast. It was great fun looking back. Boy, you reminded me of a lot of stuff I completely forgot I didn't have in the show notes. Alkaline batteries, what a concept. So anyway, this is a lot of fun. Thank you so much, Frank. Thank you, John. And we will talk to you next time.